One that was provided is to have you comment on the position and role and influence of advertisers on the editorial content and overall news coverage and questions of self-censorship. If it was true even as early as 1967 in James Reston's book, The Artillery of the Press, that 75% of media revenues come from advertisers, and that more recently that figure seems to be around 85%, and that people pull their ads when they see critical articles towards U.S. foreign policy, either towards the Palestinians or towards Israel, and that they are within their legal rights to do that, and that publications' shareholders are driven by the bottom line. They don't want any advertisers to pull their ads. Can you comment on this aspect and what, if anything, can be done about it? And is it a kind of deal maker or breaker for the American media dealing with these issues?
Any takers?
Any takers?
No.
Well, briefly, the media scene in America and the media scene in the Arab world and in the world in general has changed radically in the last 10, 15 years because of the satellite phenomena, because of the blogosphere, because of the diminution, if you will, of the old control of few networks, few executives, few publications, in fact. This changing media landscape is making it difficult for the old practices to remain, including the power of the advertisers. I don't want to diminish that, but I know this is somewhat unorthodox for Arab reporters. I am not a basher of American media. I used to be more strident in my critique of the American media 25 years ago when I began in this business in this city. But I've seen the trajectory of what happened in the last 25 years. And I can give you chapter and verse about how the American media has improved a lot, particularly print media. When you talk to Arabs, they talk about the American media and they say, well, American media is synonymous with Fox. Well, no, the American media is not synonymous with Fox. And great things are published by the American media. Great things are published by the American media. The American media covered Sabra and Shatila's massacres in a more dignified, professional way than all the Arab media put together. Make no mistake. It was the American media that uncovered Abu Ghraib, the New Yorker and the CBS. It was the American media that talked about, that revealed that the CIA is in charge of an international prison system in the world, Washington Post. It was the media that uncovered the NSA's involvement in listening on probably some of our conversations overseas. That's the New York Times. It was the media that uncovered certain massacres in Iraq, such as Haditha. This was Time magazine. This is the American media, which I criticized during the run-up of the Iraq War because they did not engage in the usual cynical questioning of authority. And they did engage later on, a few months afterwards, when we found out that there was no weapons of mass destruction, all that nonsense, and no relationship between Al-Qaeda and that awful regime of Saddam Hussein. They did engage in their own version of self-flagellation and mea culpa. I've always said, and I will continue to say, that the American media always gets the story right. The problem with the American media, it does not get the story right at the right time sometimes. But really, look at the editorial today in the Washington Post about Rashid Khalidi and the dumbing of America by the McCain campaign, which keep insulting the intelligence of the American people on a daily basis. And look at how people saw and dealt with General Colin Powell when he said what he said on Meet the Press. Yes, some people still demonize the Arabs. Some people still demonize Islam in this country. And of course, on the other side there, we have our own nuts too. But today, you can still find serious reporting on Iraq and the American media, although in the last few years, because of the violence, we didn't see that. But nobody in the Arab world writes as beautifully as Anthony Shadid when he was writing about Iraq and what that war did to Iraq. I remember when the Israelis, you know, during the first days of the Intifada, you did on the front page of the New York Times, Deborah Sontag's dispatches from the occupied territories. First-rate journalism. Even the Wall Street Journal. You can still find some. The Wall Street Journal, by the way, if you overlook the editorial BS, is sometimes gives you good reporting. It was the Wall Street Journal that said initially after Abu Ghraib that the International Red Cross sent the American Army a detailed study talking about the abuse at Abu Ghraib. The Wall Street Journal, which supported the war. So, I mean, when we talk about the American media, at least we should be a little bit, you know, kind of more sophisticated than what sometimes you read in the Arab media about the American media.
Let me just add to that. I think that everything that's just been said is true. And America's print media is definitely much better than our TV news media. Unfortunately, if you look at viewership and where people actually get their news, it is primarily from TV news media. And the most watched TV channel is Fox News. If we look at the sources of information of the general American public is TV news media, primarily Fox News, which has many, many more viewers than say CNN or BBC, certainly. And if you look at Fox News, and if you look at just the three top TV news medias, a firm out of Germany called Media Tenor did a media content analysis over the period of the beginning of 2007 until March of 2008 and looked at how Islam and Muslims were portrayed in that time period of about 18 months. And what they found was that the majority of coverage on Islam was negative. They actually went and did a qualitative analysis of all statements made. In news, this isn't editorials, but just news, it should be neutral. It shouldn't be positive. It shouldn't be negative. But when you have the majority actually being negative, that's alarming. The other thing is they looked at protagonists, who was representing Islam. And they found that 53% of the time, it was militants. So if you look at 53% of representation of a faith is militants, when militants only make up a fraction of 1% of the actual population of Muslims, this is alarming. And what we found in our research at Gallup is that exact time period, American views of Muslims went from a negative 4 to a negative 17. From the beginning of 2007 until 2008 in March, it actually got worse, despite the fact that there were no terrorist attacks during that time period, and the violence in Iraq had actually improved. So the American news media is having a detrimental effect on American public opinion when it comes to Muslims, in spite of the fact that world events have actually improved.
Okay, Dalia, if I may just if I may call on you again with a question, and if I could urge all three of you to be brief to the extent possible, because we're running out of time and we have an awful lot of questions and issues to go through. There's a question specifically addressed to you from the audience asking what are the differences between the opinions of Arab Americans and Arabs in the Arab world?
I unfortunately can't answer that because we haven't completed our Muslim American data set yet, and that will be complete at the end of this year. So I can't answer the question.
Okay. Muhammad, we have another question from the audience, and they're asking about the reaction of Muslim elites to Obama's speech a few months ago before AIPAC.
It was very negative in the Arab media. It was reported all over main media, main and major outlet in the Arab world. And there is no surprise here. Last week, Colin Powell had a great statement about Obama and whether if he were a Muslim, what's wrong being a Muslim and running for the White House. And unfortunately, it was not widely reported in the Arab media as the report about Obama's speech for AIPAC in June this year.
And I'll stay with you for the next question. Can any American president recover the image of the United States in the Arab world? And what should be the first steps that a new American president should take?
The American image is a very complicated issue. I doubt any president will be able to fix the entire problem. Yet Obama's victory will be a great correction in the right direction to correct American image. It will be very difficult for American enemy abroad to attack America based on racials or anti-Islamic or biased or money role or Jewish lobby as a stereotype for attacking America in the region. I believe it will be very, very difficult for American enemies to attack it based on these realities. What the next president should do, it's very difficult because America in the region is there. There is 250,000 Americans in the Middle East, in the Arab world, in form of occupation in Iraq or scholars in Egypt or Syria or expats in any international organizations there. So America is the reality in the region, and to get by it, it's very difficult. What any Arab will wish, of course, to American to be a leading force to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, but it has been a disaster for 60 years, and any realistic analyst will not expect they will fix it in next administration or next few years. What he is supposed to be doing if he elects the president, I believe, to distance himself a little bit with American, with the Arab regimes. If he talk directly to Arab people, they may listen. But this hypocrisy of dealing with non-democratic regime is very difficult for Arab to like anything about America when they are distancing themselves from the value that America stands for.
Okay, Hisham, we have a similar question, but coming at it from a slightly different angle. Many have said that a new U.S. president should go on a listening tour early in his term. Now, specifically in the case of Barack Obama, given all the flack that he's been getting about trying to distance himself from Arabs and Muslims in this country, is there any practical value in him undertaking such a tour in the region?
After Karen Hughes' disastrous listening tour, I wouldn't advise the Barack Obama administration to engage in a quick listening tour. It's not a question of listening tours. I mean, it's that, you know, as if we don't know what's happening there. Or as if, I mean, when somebody tells you, well, I have new ideas about how to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. Oh, give me a break. We all know how it should be resolved. We all know the contours of peace. We all know what ailing America's relationship with the Arab and the Muslim world. And by the way, I mean, if he speaks to Arabs, I'm going to tell you, he is going to talk to the Arabs the way he talked to the African Americans. He's going to give them some tough love. And he's not going to tell them, oh, you Muslims are great people. And he shouldn't say that. He shouldn't say that. Because there is so many things that are rotten in that whole world we call the Muslim world. And the people are in the whole, in the main, responsible for what is rotten in the Kingdom of Islam and the Arab world are Muslims and Arabs themselves. But when it talks to America's image in the Arab world, let me tell you, images are, perceptions and images change. They are not etched in stone. For most of America's history with the Arabs, America's legacy in the Arab world was positive. Arabs and Muslims looked up to America. They loved the Wilsonian declarations. They loved the fact that the United States did not have a colonial legacy in the Arabs and the Muslim world. They love the fact that Americans did not rule over Muslims, like the Brits, the French, the Spaniards, even the Italians, for crying out loud. Okay? Things began to go south in 1948. Dwight Eisenhower corrected it in 1956. John F. Kennedy was lionized in Algeria because he supported the Algerian fight for independence. Things could change if there is a different American approach to the problems of the Arab world, including the Arab-Israeli conflict, because there are more problems in the region that go beyond the Arab-Israeli conflict. But perceptions do change, and I think if Obama is elected president, he is going to say some tough things to the Arabs and the Muslims, as he should, as long as he couples that with a different approach that takes them seriously, treat them as grown-ups, and demand certain things from them and listen and change certain American attitudes and policies in the Middle East. Things are not going to happen immediately and quickly. He will be the President of the United States, but he will not be an absolute ruler, and there will be constraints, as we've seen even during the campaign. So I hope the Arabs also don't have too high hopes, as many Americans do, pin them on this young man, because the world that he's going to inherit is going to be a messy one. And it's going to take more than 4 years, believe me, to fix the damage inside this country. So those who are saying we are going to enter a new period similar to what happened after 1932 with the great FDR, well, FDR was elected 4 times, and then he made the changes. I don't know. I think you're going to need 8 years of Barack Obama, and we have to pray for him, including people like me who don't pray often.
Okay. Certainly some provocative food for thought there. Now... Muhammad,
might as well do it. I'm leaving.
Muhammad, another question about Barack Obama from the audience, and it's asking about the extent of the Arab world's awareness of the issue of terrorism being used to smear Obama, as the question says, by associating him with the Arabs here in the United States.
This kind of news is widely reported in the Arab media. Average newspaper in any Arab country dedicated at least 2 pages in average to the American news. So any piece of news we hear here, it's in no time is reported there. And thanks to technology, there is nothing hidden anymore about America. America is very accessible today compared with any time I ever been here. And... details about American political life, American election is all over there, and TV stations, and websites, news, and daily newspaper, and blogs, and forum, and Facebook as well. There's a lot of associations of Arabs and Muslims who are for Obama and for the Democratic nominee in Congress in general. All these kind of attacks against Obama here, based on his connection to Palestinian professors or Islamists or Arab money, it's widely reported there. Yet, the good news, it's in the same page you may find a poll by Gallup or Reuters showing that Obama ahead in major states by 2 digits. So it's there is bad news and good news. And I believe this has confusion created for most Arabs when they see a lot of attacks against Obama based on his Islamic connection, as used by McCain campaign. And in the next part of the same page in the newspaper, you will see he's leading in the poll. I believe it's very healthy to see this kind of America in our newspaper.
Okay, we have another question actually addressed specifically to you, Muhammad, in light of the amazing use that the Obama campaign has made of the electronic media, and the question is asking, how has the blogosphere changed the atmosphere, structure, and impact of journalism in the Arab world, and who reads what you personally write electronically? Do you think you have a stronger or weaker impact on opinion than the print media in the Arab world?
I work for a non-profit organization, American non-profit organization, and we are free of money influence and advertisement. We have no advertisement, and we have no governmental role. We have just money from foundations like Ford and Carnegie of New York, and private citizens like yourself here. And this gave me and my news agency, Tucker Washington, great freedom of reporting America as I understand, as I lived it here. And we are trying to be free reporters for Arab media that are not privileged to have resources to have a place in Washington here. So we are free reporting to main newspapers that they can't afford to be here. And what we write is reprinted in dozens of newspapers every week, and we are weekly news service so far. And they like to take from us what they can't find in mainstream Arab media outlets. Like we cover like nobody else, I claim, the Congress, the election in Congress, which forgotten in major news paper and media outlet in the Arab world, because we care much as an American association about the Congress and the role of the Congress in Arab media, which forgotten in Arab media, sadly. There is no such a congressional reporter in any Arab news agency or TV stations, though they have the resources. And that's led to a bigger issue of how to deal as Arab government or Arab embassies or Arab public even with the Congress. We have a serious problem, and maybe it's driven by the fact we are very centralized in our region on the presidency, on the head of the state, and we think America is similar in terms of focusing on the White House and ignoring the other part of the region. When we write some stories about Arab Americans in positive way, which really doesn't make news in many major newspapers, it's widely picked and reprinted, and we try to present as well the sophisticated America that other media can't afford to provide, like book reviews and event summary, which we have weekly only deadline once a week. So we have competitive advantage compared with other media because they are working through the hours, but I work through the day.
Okay. Dalia, we have an issue concerning, not directly though, immigration. It's a subject of great importance, as you probably know, in the Arab world, given the numbers of people who have over the years emigrated from the region. And on the merit of that alone, there's obviously a special way of perceiving Barack Obama being the son of an immigrant father. Now, the question says, why did you describe Obama as the son of poor immigrants? Certainly, wealth is relative, but he is for sure the son of scholars. His father has a PhD, and he was an economist, and his mother was a PhD and an anthropologist.
Well, I don't think I described him as the son of poor immigrants. What I meant to say and thought I did say was that he was the son of an African immigrant. So it's more that he had one of his parents was an immigrant. The other, of course, was national-born American. I think that his biography, like I said, is significant and does make people question their old assumptions about America. And oftentimes I've heard from people the same question that Muhammad just mentioned. Will Americans really ever elect a black man whose middle name is Hussein? It completely flies in the face of everything that people believe about America. And I think electing him will imbue more new hope in the American public, but not necessarily new hope in policy changes. That's the distinction I'm trying to make. What we asked for people to tell us how much hope they place in different approaches to changing U.S. policy. And the thing that they said was the most significant, that they had the most hope in, was the American public putting pressure on their government. It got more, people put more hope in it than dialogue between leaders from both countries, more hope than specifically Muslim Americans being more active, more hope than their own government's diplomatic approaches, and much, much more hope than local protests in their countries or, of course, terrorist attacks against American civilians. So if there is any hope, it is placed in the American people, and the election of Obama will be, I think, seen as a renewed hope in those American values that people believe the American people hold. But that change, I don't think people have the amount of, they don't have the unrealistic expectations that we might assume they do, just because many people are saying that they don't think a change in the White House will actually be a change in reference to policies toward their country.
Okay, I think we only have very few minutes left in this panel, but let me throw another question at you. It's actually from the audience directed specifically to you, and it's about your book. And it says that your book, co-authored with John Esposito, has become the target of significant criticism, largely on political grounds. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would differ with the word significant. It's not significant at all, actually. We've had significant praise, and I'm very proud to say, from a wide spectrum of intellectuals in this country, ranging from a conservative like Dinesh D'Souza to someone who supported the Iraq War like Ken Pollack to Desmond Tutu to the former CIA head of the Bin Laden unit, Michael Scheuer. So we've actually had wide ranging praise from a spectrum of intellectuals. And the criticism has been from a very narrow point of view, and it has not been significant, although it has been echoed in the right-wing blogosphere. But it's essentially been from two individuals. My response is the data stands for itself. The data speaks for itself. And Gallup is a name that isn't going to risk its reputation in putting out something that's biased and that isn't accurate. And basically, the end of the day, Gallup as a name to be a name into the future, it is in its self-interest to be completely objective and accurate. And those who are criticizing it, it is in their self-interest to be biased and political. So, I mean, look at self-interest, and you can decide for yourself who might be telling it like it is.
Okay. Hisham has a commitment which he has to go and take care of. So, Hisham, if you would like to...
Like to be released.
If we release you.
Do you have one more for me? I'll
sure. I have one for you. By the way, Dr. Anthony has a question. Should we let him ask it, do you think?
No, it's from here. It's one that's from here.
Okay.
And it says, assume that the media is far more effective and influential in educating people in that knowledge and understanding, and then freeze that thought, and then contrast it with another reality where this one deals with the American political finance campaigns and the role of money in the politicization of America's electoral dynamics. The references to Richard Clark, the former National Security Advisor for Counterterrorism's book, recent out, Your Government Failed You, in which he writes that in each administration there are 9,000 political appointees that the president has very little leeway to reject because these 9,000 are thrust upon her or him by the donors to their campaign war chest in primaries and the general election. And many of these individuals agreed to contribute only after they asked the candidates what would be their position on Jerusalem or Palestine or Iran. And in order to get their check, the candidate was in a corner. So the question is that as most of these check writers are not the niece of Desmond Tutu or the nephew of Nelson Mandela or the sister of Mother Teresa, even if the media made a profound change, what difference would it really make?
That's for me?
Yeah.
Look, I mean, we've written a lot about the role of money in American politics, and we've seen it this year, and there is this huge debate about public financing, and maybe we should go that route. This is a capitalist society, and money talks, unfortunately, and you always go back to the original the framers of the constitutions when they were talking about an informed citizenry. And I still think, notwithstanding the role of money, people in society, if they are very well informed and if they are driven by a sense of fairness and fairness can still change things. I mean, you know, when we talk about lobbies, I mean, Arabs love to talk about the lobby, the pro-Israeli lobby, this lobby and that lobby. And there is something fascinating about this country, which undermines democracy. I'll give you one example, but two lobbies. The National Rifle Association, NRA, and then the pro-Israeli lobby, let's say, AIPAC. I mean, it's not secret. I mean, I don't believe in this whole nonsense about the Jewish cabal and all that shit. It doesn't exist. The point is, there are certain criteria for the success of any lobby, particularly a lobby that generates a great deal of enthusiasm and controversy. The majority of the American people support gun control. And yet we don't have gun control specifically because we have a powerful lobby. Now, what happens with this lobby? This lobby, the members of this lobby participate in every electoral cycle, local, national, state level, whether there's a blizzard or sunshine, they always vote. These people provide funds and money, and they are driven by enthusiasm for that single cause. These are the three magic ingredients. Now, on the Palestine issue, most American people, and I can give you a million opinion poll, either support a Palestinian state or don't mind a Palestinian state. And yet we don't see the Congress crazy about this, although they now, in the last few years, and maybe 10 years or whatever, everybody's talking about two states and along the line of 67 or whatever. Why? Because there's a small vocal group of people, American Jews and their friends, and the Israeli pro-Israeli lobby friends, as John McCain keeps telling his people, are not necessarily Jews. I mean, I'm frightened more about the religious right in that lobby, if you want to call it, than the liberal Jews, with whom I agree on a lot of things, not on Israeli policy or Israeli settlements. But there is enthusiasm. People contribute funds. And Jews in this country, because they are highly educated and highly involved in politics, as they should, like other minorities, like the Armenians, the Greeks, the Lebanese, and whatever, they vote with larger proportion than the average American, the average Joe the Plumber and the six packs, you know. So there are ways of dealing with these things. Instead of complaining about this money, contribute money. Play a role, be an informed citizen. Go into the arena. In this country, notwithstanding what we read sometimes, people can do things. And whether we're talking about the struggle of labor movement in this country, whether we're talking about the struggle of women for universal suffrage, whether we're talking about the struggle of the African Americans or other minorities, the history of this country is written by people like that, who struggled and who worked and who walked in the streets and found themselves facing dogs and you name it. I mean, this is still a democracy, and this whole notion that everybody who writes a check is going to ask the president what is your views on Jerusalem, I don't necessarily buy. And I can tell you there are a lot of Jews who are giving money who don't like Israeli politics. They don't like Israeli politics. Many of my Jewish friends and others who are as horrified about what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians write about these things, and they talk about these things. And so it's not that we don't have allies in this society. It's that sometimes Arabs, as always, and I don't want to generalize because, I mean, you know, they love to complain. And they wring their heads, and they talk about conspiracies. And, you know, and they don't do what they're supposed to do. Go into the arena, be enthusiastic about a cause, try to pay some money if you have some money, and vote and vote and vote. As I did.
Okay.
Gotta go.
Okay. Thanks, Hisham. And I think on that note, we'll conclude this panel. Thanks very much, Hisham Milham. Thanks also to Dalia Mugahid and to Muhammad Al-Minshawi. Dr. Anthony, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Fakara. Will Ambassador Hussein Asuna please join us? Yes. Last but not least, His Excellency Dr. Hussein Hassuna, who has addressed numerous of these conferences. He's ambassador of the League of Arab States to the United States. He's been a longtime representative before coming to those positions, diplomat in Egypt's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, where he was assistant foreign minister of Egypt, and also representative for many years at the United Nations as the League of Arab States ambassador, where he was exposed to many world problems. He was also ambassador of Egypt to Morocco, ambassador to Yugoslavia. He has his PhD in law from Cambridge, and in the last 2 years, he got the most votes of any lawyer specialist in jurisprudence in the world to be appointed to the International Law Commission in Geneva, which is the central body for the United Nations codifying international law and the norms of interstate behavior. Ambassador Hassuna.
Good afternoon, everyone. I know it has been a long session, that you are all tired, and that there were many interesting discussions. But I have been asked by my friend, Dr. John Duke Anthony, to make some concluding remarks, which I will do. My first one is that it seems that this year there has been an increased number in the audience attending this conference. So I wonder, is this because John Duke Anthony has become more popular for some reason? I think it is rather because the subject matter of the conference is so important. Relations between the United States and the Arab world. Where are they heading? What are the problems, the challenges? And I think this is what this audience came to listen to understand. I think the importance of this conference was both because of its theme and because of its timing. Because of its theme, because it dealt with a subject of topical importance, relations between the Arab world and the United States, which are strategic relations based on a strong interdependency. And there are some crucial issues in these relationships. Crisis in the Middle East, the oil, the culture, extremism, the policies of the United States vis-a-vis the Arab and the Muslim world. All these issues are of great importance to both the United States and to the Arab world. September 11 had a dramatic effect on our relationship. It was devastating. And I think we have to realize this and take into account, because September 11 led to the emergence of two concepts or notions which were damaging to our relationship. The first was the notion in this country as to whether the Arab world and the Muslim world hated the United States. And of course, the answer is no. The Arab world and the United States do not hate the United States. They respect the United States. Arab people love the United States, the lifestyle, the knowledge, the progress. And that is why so many Arabs and Muslims apply to come and live in the United States or send their children to school in the United States. But what the Arabs resent very often are the policies of the United States, which they perceive as being not fair, not objective, siding with Israel when it comes to the Arab-Israeli problem. The second notion which was unleashed by September 11 is the notion that the clash between the United States and the West in general and the Muslim and the Arab world, a clash of culture, a clash of religion, a clash of civilization. And again, this does not exist. What does exist, there is a clash between extremists on both sides, extremists in the Arab world and extremists in the United States and in the West in general. And it is up to the majority that is moderate, that believes in coexistence, that believes that we all have common human values, to stand up against those extremists. The timing of this conference, in my view, was also extremely important. Again, for two reasons. One, because we all face a global financial crisis of devastating proportions. And this crisis is affecting everyone. It's affecting individuals, it's affecting governments, and it's even affecting the presidential elections in this country. This crisis has deep-rooted causes. But I think the lessons we can draw is that it happened because we live in an interdependent world, in a global world. What happened started in the United States has affected the rest of the world. I think we also have a collective responsibility towards this crisis. It is not only one institution, one bank that is responsible. It is a collective responsibility for all. That is why it has spread all over the world. But I think also one of the reasons we have this crisis, that there was an absence of the rule of law in dealing with these financial and economic issues. There was an absence of transparency. There was an absence of accountability for those responsible. And I think it is time to deal with the deep-rooted causes of the crisis, to engage in a reform that is not just superficial and contain the crisis, but we have to reform the whole system so that this crisis will not recur anymore. And here I believe that it was wise to have this World Conference meeting in Washington on the 15th of May, of November, to try and reform the whole system. We have to reform the institutions, the Bretton Woods institution that have survived for over the years, but that need to be reformed also. I think we have to create a system that is more ethical, that is even more human, I would say, and not just materialistic as it has been for so long. The Arab world has been involved in trying to help and assist in the crisis. Many countries of the oil-producing countries in the Arab world have already provided assistance to the developing countries when those countries were afflicted by the skyrocketing food prices. And they have given a lot of assistance to the World Food Program. You also know that the sovereign funds have played an important role in helping, providing capital in the developed markets in the world. And they continue to do so. So I think a partnership and a cooperation between the Arab world and the developed world, and especially the United States, is called for and should continue in the days and the years ahead. The second importance of this conference, apart from the financial crisis, it's the timing that it is at the eve of the elections. I think we had already many panels dealing with this question of elections. What does the Arab world expect from a new administration? Let me share my own thoughts about that. First of all, we have all followed the campaign. The presidential campaign, I think it was a model of democracy at work. Yes, we in the Arab world, we have to draw lessons for our own democracies. We've seen how there has been a campaign, how the candidates expressed themselves, how they plan their campaign, how they enlist support. And it is really a lesson for the rest of the world. But of course, there were also things which we cannot condone or accept, like racial profiling, like Islamophobia, and other abuses. And I think we were all gratified to hear some courageous men like Colin Powell when he questioned, what about if Obama was a Muslim? Some others also saying, what about if Obama is called Obama Hussein Barack? By the way, this is my name also. So I think that there was a reaction to those abuses, and this was healthy, and we applaud those people who reacted to that. A new president, in my view, is not going to dramatically change the policies of the United States. The United States is today the only superpower in the world. In spite of its weaknesses, it still has strong institutions and long-term strategic interests. And it will continue the same policies. But a new administration can certainly change its approaches, its style, its discourse. And this, in my view, can have an impact on its relations with the rest of the world. I agree with those who said that a new president should try to become a model for others, to be a leader, to adopt fair policies, to listen to the grievances and the concerns of the rest of the world, and not just impose the views of the United States on the others. I think this is crucial for a new administration. I also think that a new president should adopt policies towards the Middle East, especially with regard to the Arab-Israeli problems, that are fair. Pursue a policy of peace based on justice, because without justice, there can be no lasting peace in our part of the world. This means that a new president should continue the peace process, should carry on what has been achieved so far. We know that the Annapolis conference raised many hopes in the region, but that unfortunately those hopes were not fulfilled, since so far we have had no agreement. Yes, there was a new negotiating process that was started. Yes, that this process dealt with all the issues, including the difficult ones like the status of Jerusalem and the status of the refugees. But there was no conclusion, no commitment, nothing in writing. And of course, all this was undermined by Israelis' policies concerning the settlements in the occupied territories, which in the words of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice did not provide the conducive climate to make negotiations succeed. So I think a new president has to get involved in this Arab-Israeli conflict that is still in the hearts and the minds of the people of the Middle East, the crux of the problems. And I think he has to do it at an early stage in the administration and not to leave it like has been done by previous administrations to the last year or month of an administration. And I think that the Arab Peace Initiative, adopted at the Beirut Summit Conference of 2002, still provides the best framework for a balanced, comprehensive settlement of the issue. The Israelis have lately shown some interest in it. They have asked to negotiate some terms of this resolution. I don't think it can be negotiated upon. I think it has to be implemented because it's a carefully drafted initiative that is very balanced and that has both sides abide by certain obligations, mainly peace versus land, total withdrawal of the occupied territories, settlement of the Palestinian refugee problem, independent state for Palestine, versus total diplomatic relations between the Arab world and Israel. It can still happen. It is not a dream. I have been involved for many years in the peace process between Egypt and Israel, and I think that with hard work, with dedication, with an effective role of the United States as an honest broker, not siding with Israel, but being even-handed, I think that we can reach a settlement. I also think that the next president should adopt an approach of trying to settle crises and conflicts through diplomacy and not through threats and sanctions, because we've seen that it doesn't work. That's why I deplore what has happened lately when the United States launched this raid against Syria, because it has repercussions. It has repercussions not only within Syria, but within the Muslim and Arab world. It affects the image of the United States, that it is resorting to force, that it is not ready to negotiate, to try and settle the problem peacefully. And already we've seen that maybe the cooperation between the United States and Syria and Iraq along the border between Syria and Iraq might be affected. So it has long-term repercussions. I also think that the problem of the Sudan and of Darfur should be resorted through political means, that we should all try to get the government of Sudan together with all the rebel groups together around a table. And the Arab League has proposed to do this at a meeting in September. The Arab Council of Ministers had decided to convene a conference in Doha where all parties of the conflict will be present. So I think through negotiations and diplomacy, we can find solution to difficult problems. The same has happened in Lebanon. Lebanon, for so long, was the scene of conflict. And again, it is through collective efforts of the Arab world and the Arab League that we have today a new president, that we have today a government, that we have dialogue between the main parties in Lebanon. And I think it proves that Arab problems should be settled through Arab means and Arab solutions, and not leave it to outside forces to intervene and adopt solutions according to their own interests and their own agendas. I also believe a new president should support multilateral approaches and not unilateral approaches. For instance, in the Middle East today, the issue of Iran. In my view, it can be solved through a multilateral approach Yes, Iran should not have weapons of mass destruction, but it has the right to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. And the way to prevent Iran to have weapons of mass destruction is to establish in the Middle East a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction, a zone under which all countries in the region would give up their weapons of mass destruction and abide by international supervision and control. And this includes Israel, Israel that has today weapons of mass destruction. This is the only solution, in my view, but it is a fair solution. I also believe that the United States, under a new administration, should support the United Nations. The United Nations, that is the global organization where every country is represented. But it should also support implementing United Nations in a fair way. It shouldn't be just applied versus certain countries and not versus others. The veto should not be abused. I think that the United States also should respect international law, respect the Geneva Conventions, respect the opinions of the International Court of Judges, of Justice, including the advisory opinion rendered by the court on the question of the illegality of the Israeli wall inside Palestinian occupied territory. So many things should be done by the new administration. It should join international conventions. I don't know how many of you know that the United States has not joined some major conventions in the world, like the Convention on the Law of the Sea, the Convention on the Protection of the Child, major convention which the International Criminal Court, which the rest of the world has joined. We need a world based on the rule of law if we're going to have a better world. And I think that the United States should also try to resolve the question of extremists in the world through dealing with the root causes, not just through military means, but dealing with really the causes of extremism and terrorism, which very much are the feeling of despair, which very much are the economic and social problems in our part of the world, unemployment, illiteracy, and so on. I think there should be a big effort to deal with those issues, which might have an impact in overcoming extremism in our part of the world. And then I think the United States should also try and support democratic changes in the region. And I accept that we need more democracy. There are changes happening, but we need more. And this is the wish and the aspiration of all Arab people. But I think these changes should not be a model imposed by the United States from abroad. It should take into account the cultural and the religious heritage of the countries concerned. I also think that there are many other ways which the United States can help the Arab world and develop friendly relations with the United States. For instance, in the economic sphere, the Arabs now are engaged in important efforts aiming at cooperation among themselves, at economic integration. In January of next year, there will be the first Arab Economic Summit meeting. It will be held in Kuwait. It will deal with the economic issues confronting the Arab world, economic and social issues. Economic issues, the process of integration. Already in 2005, the Arab League has adopted a free trade zone between the members of the League. It will lead to a customs union. And hopefully by 2020, there will be an Arab common market along the model of the European common market. So this conference is going to discuss this process. But it will also address other issues of human development, of education in the Arab world. I think it is a very important conference because for the first time, all the head of states of the Arab world have committed themselves to get involved in this and to give it a priority. I think that relations, of course, between the United States and the Arab world and the economic field are evolving. There are many free trade agreements. And the cooperation with the oil-producing countries, also in the fear of stabilizing prices and so on, should continue and go on. Education and culture are essential. Education, again, is a top priority for the Arab world. Because without education, there can be no real attempt to combat poverty, unemployment, extremism. Education is the key. It's the key for countries and for people to prosper. And there's a real effort now in the Arab world to focus on education reform. The next 10 years have been proclaimed as a decade for education reform. And the United States can help with its expertise, can help with its scientific knowledge, and I think that this is an important sphere of potential cooperation between the United States and the Arab world. Culture, again, is extremely important. It is through culture that people get together. It is through culture that people can understand each other more, that it opens the minds. It makes you realize that we all have common values. And that is why I think it's extremely important to get involved in cultural initiatives. I will mention to you just two kind of initiatives which I think will have an impact on U.S.-Arab relations. One is that on the 23rd of February of next year, there will be the first Arab cultural festival in the United States. We have been working, the Arab League, with the Kennedy Center to have this festival. It will be a festival of arts and culture. It will be called Arabesque. For the first time, the 22 countries of the Arab League will be represented and will take part in this festival. There were many, of course, artists from different Arab worlds, many exhibitions before, but never have the 22 countries together taken part in an event like this, including the smallest Arab countries, one of the smallest ones, that is the Comoro Islands. I'm not sure you know where it is. But the Comoro Islands will send some of their artists to take part in this festival as well. It will go on for 3 weeks. So I urge you all to go and enjoy the best we have in terms of art, 23rd of February, for 3 weeks. I think the message of this festival is that the Arabs have a great culture and a great civilization, and that it should not be just perceived as being sometimes backward or extremists, but that their civilization and their culture have contributed and still contribute to the world culture and civilization. The second initiative is the initiative of our wives, the wives of the Arab ambassadors in Washington. They have something called the Mosaic Foundation, which some of you know about. And this is a NGO devoted to promote ties between the United States and the Arab world in the cultural field, to promote Arab culture, to organize events and activities about Arab culture. And I think they're doing a great job, and they also have an annual gala, and the proceeds of that gala goes to charities in the United States and in the Arab world, especially charities concerning women and children. So I think we should thank them for that. I just would like to conclude by saying, yes, the Arab world and the United States, they're both facing great challenges. Challenges to strengthen a relationship, to to dispel the misconceptions, to promote a better understanding, to understand each other more, and to find common solutions to the problem we face. And I think it needs, on both sides, it needs efforts, sincere efforts. I think the Arabs have to come together also. And as I always say, and this is the mission of our Arab League, that they have to unite and take common stands, because this is the way where they can have more weight in dealing with others. And I think that what we need is not just understanding the issues and the challenges and analyzing them, but I think we need some proactive efforts. We need people to be more outspoken. We need those who care about U.S.-Arab relations to take part in public debate, to go on television and talk, to respond to those who attack us, or to maybe we need a kind of ground movement to have everyone involved, not only officials, not only the media, but the ordinary people. I think if we join our hands, we can overcome the challenges we are facing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador. Would Megan Geisler, Patrick Mancino, Jim Winship, Mario Pascal, and John Mulholland come forward, please, if you're in the room? Dr. Pascal, Dr. Winship, Patrick Mancino, and Megan Geisler. These kinds of events are not the work of one person or even one institution or one set of skills. From the left here is John Mulholland. He's a founding member of an advisory board. He's formerly the president of the American Business Association of Jeddah, lived a quarter of a century there, works now in the United States just outside of Atlanta. Next to him on his left is Dr. Mario Pascal. Dr. Mario Pascal is a specialist in working with children who are brain damaged and neurologically impaired. And many of these are children who were the victims of the first and second Intifada, the children who threw stones. Not so much in the region, but here throughout the United States, and previously in the Department of Education. He's the founding chairman of the National Council's affiliate, the California Committee on U.S.-Arab Relations. He has led more delegations of students and youth to the Arab world than any other single American. 8 separate ones for the high school students, on top of which he's done 6 more with university professors. There's no one like this in the United States. Dr. Mario Pascal. The youngest one, and in terms of height, the least tall of the 5 who are here is Megan Geisler. She's an alumnus of the Model Arab League program, and her roots are on the West Coast as well as in Texas. And she is the person who coordinates and choreographs these 2,500 students that we provide these leadership programs for each year. And she is one person who does that with lots of volunteers. Megan Geisler. And many of you have seen 2 individuals who have been peripatetic, meaning ubiquitous, meaning everywhere, in terms of the conference. Our newest staff member is Dr. James Winship. He is an alumnus of the Malone Fellows in Arab and Islamic Studies program. I mentioned we have somebody at 800 universities. He retired, left here, and now he's full-time with us as vice president for programs, which include the Malone Fellows program and the internship program as well. Dr. Winship. And by no means the last or least, but who is a household name and a friendly voice on the telephone for each of you and those amongst the supporters, that tug at the end of the skirt or at the end of the coat there to cajole, not coerce, but persuade, inspire, and entice people to support this kind of a venture. He has had 6 years on Capitol Hill as the staff assistant to Congresswoman Mary Rose Okar, herself a leader from his own native town of Cleveland. And he was also the assistant to the president and director of development at a pioneering grassroots organization of the kind that Ambassador Hussein referred to, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. He's the National Council's vice president and director for development and has been centrally involved, as have the others, in making this conference.
Dr. Anthony said last but not least, but I just want to, on behalf of the staff and I'm sure Admiral Burnson and the board, just take this opportunity to thank someone that has inspired many, has just done so much in the field of improving understanding between the Arab world and this great country, the United States of America. 25 years of doing this is no easy task. It's monumental. It's really incredible to think that the vision of one man and a series of people 25 years ago and what has just happened in 25 years is a quarter of a century is just really astonishing and just incredible. Let's give a big round of applause to the founding, the founder, the president, and CEO and the visionary of the National Council on U.S. Arab Relations, Dr. John Duke Anthony.
Thank you all. As I said, this is not one person's dream alone, and they struggle even less so. One thing I've neglected to mention about Dr. Pascal, in addition to the other attributes associated with who he is and what he is, 45 years ago this year, he took a delegation of young Americans who had never been to the Arab world, for their first time. I was one of those individuals. I lived in a family in Egypt. We worked and visited the Gaza Strip. We sailed with the Egyptian Navy down the Red Sea. We saw almost all of Upper and Lower Egypt. He was the individual that touched not only myself and the others, but in this building is the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Scholars. It's headed by former Congressman Lee Hamilton. Its director is Michael Van Dusen, who was also in that delegation. Now, in bringing this to a close, there is a draw for the two tickets of Qatar Airways that have been generously provided here. But as a closing statement, much of what has transpired here has been inspirational, certainly to me and I believe to most others there. And underscoring it all in terms of Ambassador Hassouna's commentary was a need to not take trust for granted, not rest on one's laurels or perceive that one's record of goodwill that existed almost without blemish or criticism up until half a century ago. Nurture it, protect it, defend it, strengthen it, expand it. It won't happen by accident. It won't happen by coincidence. To paraphrase Edmund Burke, it will happen only if a enough good people not only do nothing, but become engaged. Democracy is not a spectator sport. It's a participatory exercise. And one cannot blame others for things that one has an ability to change, to contribute to improve, to make better. And this relationship, in terms of the restoration and the expansion of trust, cannot be a one-way street. It cannot be in the moment of the international crisis that the United States and others face, that Ambassador Hassuna touched on. It cannot be just the United States going with begging bowl in hand and bib on and pleading with Arab countries in China to fix an American-rooted and based problem for which the United States admittedly has a disproportionate degree of responsibility for causing as well as for remedying it. It is to be a multilateral, collective, global effort. Cannot just be bilateral. Certainly in the case of Pakistan and Hungary, this is a multilateral challenge here. If Pakistan fails and falls, the repercussions are limited only by one's imagination. And then lastly, from whatever one has gathered here that one can take away and use, don't worry about plagiarizing. Don't worry about footnoting or documenting it. Be free to paraphrase. For the following is true. Nothing of what has been said, and no one here has a monopoly on the method. No one has a trademark on the technique. No one has a patent on the process. No one has a copyright on the concepts. Thank you for helping us make this 17th annual Arab U.S. Policymakers Conference a success.